I know that's for Dr. Oshinsky. I'll be very brief. I'm Howard Markell, and I direct the Center for the History of Medicine at the University of Michigan. And we're just absolutely delighted to co-sponsor this today's program with the Ann Arbor District Library, very purposely so that the university has and the medical school has interactions with the community it serves. The Ann Arbor District Library, as libraries like it all around the country, to me, are the greatest institution of American society. The notion that you have free access to information at the touch of a button, gosh, it sounds like the internet, but it's more than that, as you all know, and so I'm so happy everyone came today from your busy schedules. I have the privilege of introducing a wonderful colleague, a wonderful writer, a superb historian, Dr. David Oshinsky. He's professor of history at the New York University. He also directs the Division of Medical Humanities at the New York University School of Medicine. Can you imagine medical students learning about the humanities? They are doing it now. They have even here at Michigan. Some are reading Moby Dick even. So prior to that, he held distinguished professorships at the University of Texas at Austin and Rutgers University. He's a graduate of Cornell and the Brandeis University. You may have read some of his previous books because they're all winners. His book on Joe McCarthy, A Conspiracy So Immense, The World of Joe McCarthy. It may be interesting to look at that. And that was for some reason. By the way, in the Kubler-Ross stages of death and disease, denial is the first one, and I'm finding it very useful for myself. So I appreciate it. Anyway. His book, Worse Than Slavery, won the Robert F. Kennedy Book Award for Distinguished Contributions to Human Rights. And last year, David actually came as our guest to speak on Polio, an American Story, which won the Pulitzer Prize in 2006, deservedly so. Medical history rarely ascends to those heights. It did so because of David's nimble pen and brain. That Polio book helped influenced the Bill Gates Foundation, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, to target polio as an important priority. Well, today he's talking about his new book, and his new book is called, I love this, Bellevue, Three Centuries of Medicine and Mayhem in America's Most Storied Hospital, which sounds really hot. And having lived in hospitals for a long time, I can tell the stories they tell. So he's also, you've seen his byline in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and so on. But he's talking about his new book, which was just published by Doubleday this week. We will have copies for purchase and signing. And without further ado, it's just an honor to welcome David Oshinsky.
Thank you. Can you all hear me? I have a lapel mic here. Howard, thank you very much. Heidi, where are you, Heidi? I want to thank you for putting this all together. It was great. And the Ann Arbor Library as well. Dr. Markell is a very distinguished, not only pediatrician, but medical historian. And his books have wound up on the front page of the New York Sunday Times Book Review. His latest one, which was absolutely extraordinary on Sigmund Freud and William Halstead, some of you may know, became an instant classic in the field. So thank you for inviting me, Howard. I'm going to talk a bit about Bellevue Hospital. It probably, in terms of popular culture, is our most... I'm told I have to stand here, so I shall. They're filming this, and if I move this way, I'm in the shadows. If I move this way, they can't hear me. So even with a lapel mic, I'm stuck. And anyway, when you talk about popular culture, Bellevue really is the most storied hospital. It's the oldest public hospital in the United States. It goes back to the 1730s. And when you look on television today, if you look at, say, Law and Order, more people are being sent to Bellevue in more mangled conditions than you could possibly imagine. One of the reasons being that among its many attributes, Bellevue has a gigantic prison ward.
And it is where any male prisoner from Rikers Island will be sent. And what that means is you're talking about hundreds and hundreds of admissions over the years. Actually, in any given year, they have a psychiatric prison ward and a medical prison ward. It's very well guarded, although you will read in my book, there have been some notorious escapes, including a terrorist for a Puerto Rican group in the late 1970s who was a bomber, and he bombed a couple of landmarks in New York City and then blew his hands and one of his eyes off, basically, while planting a bomb, and went to Bellevue Hospital. And quite amazingly, sued the police in New York City for not allowing his fingers to be sent to Bellevue to be reattached. The police were holding them as evidence. And he escaped from Bellevue. And you may know the New York Post, which has some of the great headlines. And this was Handless, Eyeless Terrorist Escapes. And he was never found. The escape you can read about, but he was brought to a safe house in New Jersey and then to Castro's Cuba, where he still lives. And it will be interesting, well, at least under Obama when relations were getting better, whether someone like an American prisoner in Cuba would be sent back. But those are some of the stories about Bellevue. It's mainly known, I think, in popular culture as the madhouse. When I was a boy growing up, when you were bad or acting what your parents thought was a little off the beam, it was, we're going to send you to Bellevue. You're going to Bellevue. And I can't tell you how many times I heard that. And for those of you who are of my age or older, Lost Weekend, which won the Oscar as Best Picture with Ray Milland, takes place in the Bellevue Alcoholic Ward. Miracle on 34th Street, the great Christmas movie, has a scene where Kris Kringle is basically declared insane and brought to Bellevue. And then large features, for example, of The Godfather were filmed inside Bellevue or right outside. So it has that panache to it. It also has one of the great emergency departments in the world. And one of the great trauma units. So if you are a policeman and you are shot, you will be brought to Bellevue. If you're a fireman and you're overcome with smoke, Bellevue will be your destination. If you're a construction worker who falls off a crane, you will be sent to Bellevue. If the Pope were to be injured in New York City, he would be sent to Bellevue, and the president of the United States would be sent. They have special facilities, but in other words, their emergency department is so good, so absolutely good, that that is where these people go. What Bellevue is most known for, however, at the moment, it's sort of the ultimate safety net hospital. Bellevue is the hospital that turns no one away. In the 1830s, it was the Irish who were coming over during the famines in the 30s and 40s, and Bellevue was their hospital, and cholera was their disease. And then you had the Germans who came over in the 1840s and 50s, and Bellevue was their hospital, and then the Jews and the Italians. And today, Bellevue is a hospital completely dominated by people from Latin America, and from Asia and Africa and Haiti. More than 100 languages are spoken at Bellevue Hospital. When a patient comes into the emergency room, the patient is given headphones, the doctor is given headphones, and there is an interpreter somewhere else in the hospital who basically interprets for both sides and basically is very good with cultural dialects and intonations. And this is very different. And I remember asking a longtime wonderful Bellevue physician, what did you do before you had this interpreter system? He said, I'll be very honest. We asked the cleaning lady. And she, you know, we found anyone we could. Anyone speak Spanish? You know, come on over here. What is he or she telling me? And I think in a way that is quite remarkable. Bellevue, as Dr. Markle knows, is a place where one medical discovery and one medical reform after another came through that hospital, whether it be germ theory or anesthesia. As I'll show very briefly, Bellevue had the first nursing school in the United States for females, which was based on Florence Nightingale's principles. What you may not know, very few people do, is that Bellevue also had the first men's nursing school, which I mentioned in my book, closed under very sad circumstances over charges of homosexuality among the male nursing students. And the belief in the Victorian era was very, very strong that this was a woman's job and that men had to be somewhat off the beam if they would go into nursing. And it's a very, very sad story. Bellevue basically was where bacteriology got started in the United States. It was where psychiatry and public health got started in the United States. And the people who went through there, from William Halsted, whom Dr. Markle writes about, and his friend/mentor, William Welsh, you know, who basically was one of the fathers of modern medical education, it has a Michigan connection, an Ann Arbor connection. Jonas Salk spent time there. Tommy Francis, after whom your superb School of Public Health was named, was at NYU in Bellevue. Albert Sabin, the competitor to Jonas Salk, went through Bellevue and also NYU Medical School. Walter Reed. The list just goes on and on and on. And one of the things I say is that when I talk about polio, people would say, what a coincidence that Jonas Salk and Albert Sabin both went to NYU Medical School and trained at least part of their careers at Bellevue. And my answer is it's no coincidence. NYU/Bellevue, which was the great teaching hospital at that time, they were the only places that did not have a Jewish quota on the East Coast. You, as a Jew, excuse me, it was virtually impossible to go to medical school at Harvard or Yale or P&S Columbia or Cornell or Penn. The door was open at NYU, and NYU was the great feeder for Bellevue Hospital, and that basically is the story there. So what you're talking about are three centuries of progress, medicine, and mayhem. And let me just begin with a couple of slides. Okay, that is Bellevue Hospital around 1850. What you can see is that it's on the East River, around 28th Street. And we have in New York City now what is called Bedpan Alley. And Bedpan Alley are three major hospitals, the VA, the Manhattan VA, Bellevue, and Tisch Hospital, excuse me, which is NYU's private hospital, lined up one after the other. Bellevue was first, obviously. And this is Bellevue in 1850. What you notice of the river, it was also built on landfill, which will be important as I go a little bit further in the program. And the tents out front were for typhus victims. Typhus, as you may know, is a bacterial disease spread by lice. And it was brought over by immigrants. I mean, sometimes immigrants are unfairly blamed, and Dr. Markle has a wonderful chapter in his book on Mexican workers coming across the border into Texas. But in this case, when you were found to have typhus, and they weren't quite sure how to diagnose it, you were put in these tents, and in the period from about 1845 to 1855, more than a dozen Bellevue physicians died of typhus. In other words, they didn't run from the disease. They treated the disease. And I think this is, in some ways, a remarkable picture. And it gives you the sense of the kind of the imposing nature of this hospital.
Well,
that's the public perception of Bellevue from Harper's Weekly in the early 1860s. And it's a ward, probably a maternity ward, and you get the sense of what the patients were surrounded by. Was that an accurate depiction? Probably. From all I could find in the archives, the answer is yes. These are four American presidents, all from the latter half of the 19th century. Anyone want to take a guess? We obviously know Lincoln and Grant, right? Who the other two are?
Cleveland
on the right.
Harrison.
Garfield, right. So it's Lincoln, Grant, Garfield, and Cleveland. What do these four presidents have in common? The fact that all of them were treated by Bellevue physicians, not always successfully. Abraham Lincoln was treated by a young Bellevue physician named Charles Augustus Leal. It's in my book, and it's, I think, a rather interesting story. Leal had graduated from Bellevue Hospital Medical College at the tail end of the war and was sent down to a field hospital just outside Washington, D.C. He decided to buy a ticket to the theater, and he was in the theater when John Wilkes Booth shot Lincoln and jumped to the stage and fled. The actual cry went out, "Is there a doctor in the house?" And Charles Augustus Leal, 23 years old, 4 months removed from medical school, rushed to Lincoln's box and literally held the future of the Republic in his arms. He did everything he was supposed to do. He gave Lincoln liquids. He gave him a little bit of water, quite a bit of brandy, as it turned out. He kept him warm with blankets. And he decided on his own that Lincoln must not be moved to the White House. He would not survive the trip. But Lincoln should only be moved across the street, which he was. Then others took over the case, but Leal stayed till the end. Here is what is most extraordinary about Charles Augustus Leal. Due to his belief in patient confidentiality, he refused to talk about the case for decades. Finally, in the early 1900s, in 1909, on the 100th anniversary of Lincoln's birth, Leal decided he would give a speech. He was being badgered to say something. And he gave this rather remarkable speech in which he somewhat embellished what he had done. He claimed that he had given Lincoln CPR. CPR was not normally done in 1865, but was beginning to be done by 1909. And he claimed that he had moved Lincoln's chest, he had breathed air into his mouth, and the like. And he also made passing reference to the fact that he had brushed Lincoln's hair to see where the bullet had gone in. The speech was a huge success. Charles Leal had done everything he could. But about 3 years ago, a researcher at the National Archives, looking through the Surgeon General's reports, came across an interview that Leal had been forced to give within hours of Lincoln's death. In other words, people want to know what the heck happened, and they wanted to know immediately. And in this interview, Leal makes no mention of giving CPR, not something you'd forget 12 hours after the death. And he does mention that he had put his finger deep into Lincoln's head to break up clots and to search for the path of the bullet. Dr. Markle is the expert on this. This was pre-germ theory. Everybody did this. His mentor, Frank Hamilton at Bellevue, had taught him to do this. You put your finger in. You don't have to wash it. Just put it in. So what Leal had done in 1909 was to talk about CPR, but not mention the fact that he had put an unwashed finger into Lincoln's head. So there was an addition and an omission. And what he was really doing was taking what a doctor should be doing in 1909 and bringing it back to 1865. And the question is, do you blame him? And I really don't. My sense is that he had kept the secret long enough, and this type, you wish he had been more candid, but this was what you got. What I will say about Charles Augustus Leal, which in terms of compassionate care almost brings almost tears to my eyes, he stayed with Lincoln at Lincoln's bedside to the very end, to the very end. And he was holding Lincoln's hand when Lincoln died. And he was asked, why are you holding the president's hand? And he said, I wanted him to know in his blindness that he had a friend. And that's, to me, absolutely. I clear everything about Charles Augustus Leal after hearing that particular statement. Ulysses S. Grant is a little trickier. The physician at Bellevue, Grant's personal physician at Bellevue, basically told Grant during a regular physical that Grant had what looked like a cancer in his throat that he should have looked at. Grant did have it looked at. It was too late. It probably wouldn't have made any difference. These men were very heavy smokers, cigar smokers, drinkers at that time, and Grant died shortly after. He was not in the White House at this time, but he died shortly after their answer of cancer of the larynx. He did live long enough, however, to complete one of the great autobiographies ever written by a president. The most controversial is Garfield. James Garfield was elected in the election of 1880 and began serving in 1881. He was a war hero from the Civil War. He was what you'd call a moderate Republican, and by all accounts, probably would have been an excellent president. But as many of you know, as he was taking a vacation, he was walking through the main train station in Washington, D.C. In those days, there was absolutely no security, none. He was walking with Secretary of State James G. Blaine, and an assassin came up behind him and put two bullets into him. Garfield thought he was going to die, fell to the ground, and was brought back to the White House. Now, when I mentioned there was no security, there was no security. And people may be interested to learn that when Harry Truman was told he was president, Truman had been kept out of the loop by Franklin Roosevelt, who didn't think much of him, which was a big mistake. So Truman used to spend his afternoons drinking in the Senate with his buddies. And one day he's drinking in the Senate with his buddies, and Eleanor Roosevelt calls him up and says, Harry, the president just died. Get to the White House. Truman says, fine. Puts down his drink, gets to the Senate garage, gets into his Buick, and drives to the White House. That's the way it was done. And that's the way it was done 60 years after Garfield and then McKinley were assassinated. Garfield is brought back to the White House, and we know today that had he just been left alone, had the doctors not done anything, he would have been fine. One was a glancing wound, one bullet, the other landed in fatty tissue near his pancreas, but was not in any way going to kill him. What happened, however, is that among the lead physicians, indeed the most important, was a Bellevue surgeon named Frank Hamilton. Frank Hamilton came down. He was a great Civil War surgeon. Immediately started putting his finger and dirty probes into Garfield's wound. And Garfield came down with an incredible infection. An infection where there was so much, the lesions and the pus were so enormous that when he was autopsied, people the people who did the autopsy had literally rarely seen an infection that large. Garfield went down from over 200 pounds in July to about 100 pounds by the time he died on September 19th, 1881. And Frank Hamilton was basically the lead surgeon in that case. And the question is, can you blame Frank Hamilton? Leal, I think, is largely blameless, but Frank Hamilton is doing this a decade after Joseph Lister wrote about this in medical journals and wrote about antiseptic surgery and came to the United States on a tour and spoke at the American Centennial in Philadelphia about his method, which to a large extent was doing away with postoperative infection. And Frank Hamilton actually stood up in 1876 at that exhibition and told Lister that no American believed in this. I don't want to use Frank Hamilton's exact words, but they were something like, because Louis Pasteur was the model for Lister, it's, we're not going to believe the experiments of a Frenchman told us by an Englishman. We're Americans, and we do it our way. And James Garfield was a victim. Finally, Grover Cleveland. Grover Cleveland's lead physician was a Bellevue doctor. And Cleveland came with what looked like a cancerous mass in his mouth. And the doctor, his doctor, Joseph Bryant at Bellevue, actually sent, you know, a portion to be biopsied. And it was William Welsh who biopsied, the great William Welsh who biopsied. And it came back as cancerous. Cleveland, this is 1893, did not want anyone to know that he had cancer. He figured his enemies would be all over him. There was a depression going on in 1893. It would panic the public. So in one of the most remarkable episodes in medical history, a yacht was outfitted as basically an operating room. Four Bellevue physicians took the lead. The yacht went up the East River right by Bellevue with the shades down so that no one could look in and see, hey, there are four Bellevue physicians. What are they doing there? The yacht went out into the Long Island Sound to a very quiet place. And in a 90-minute operation, Cleveland's mouth was cleared of this cancerous mass along with five teeth. And Cleveland lived another 20 years before dying of a heart attack. But the point is that every part of that operation was done antiseptically. Everything was boiled, including the uniforms that were used. There was no way they were going to allow the kind of post-operative nonsense that Frank Hamilton had tolerated. And what you can say in a way is that Grover Cleveland survived, at least in part, because poor Garfield had not. That's the first Bellevue ambulance. Imagine? For those of you who've seen The Nick, the show The Nick, you see a lot of this stuff. Bellevue had the first civilian ambulance, and it came right out of the Civil War. It was diagrammed and put together by a Bellevue physician who had seen the gutbusters at Gettysburg and realized that you needed something like this in American cities, but they had to be smaller and they had to be very mobile and light so they could get through traffic. This is one of the first nursing classes at Bellevue. It was done with the Florence Nightingale method, and that was very progressive at the time. And basically, it meant that nurses were always subordinate to physicians. They must always take orders from physicians, but they were basically supposed to deal with issues like feeding patients, cleaning patients, writing letters for patients, and over time, taking actual medical courses that made them experts in the diseases that their patients had. And nurses at Bellevue until then had been what were called 10-day women. They were women who came out of the various prisons in New York City serving 10-day sentences, usually for prostitution or alcoholism, and they had provided the service. And through Florence Nightingale and a story that I tell in my book, Bellevue has the first major series of nurses. This is the Bellevue morgue, the biggest morgue in New York City and then in the United States. This was taken around 1870, and it's one of the more modern morgues because you can see that cold water is flashing down on the bodies of the victims to keep them for at least 48 hours in a condition like this. Generally, the people who went to Bellevue were very, very poor, and they wound up in one of two places. Potter's Field, I think you all know this, where the unidentified and the poor are buried, and there still is a Potter's Field in New York City on Hart Island right off the Bronx. Or else they wound up on an anatomy slab in a medical school. It was one of the two. And one of the things that was remarkable about this was that Bellevue hired a photographer, and I'll show very briefly a couple of his photographs, named O.G. Mason. And what Mason did was to photograph the face of every person in the Bellevue morgue, and then they would hang them up, and it was called the Wall of the Living Dead, so that if you couldn't get there within 48 hours, you could look at a photograph and see that your loved one had been buried on Hart Island, and you could, in fact, get the city to bring him back or her back for a real burial. As Howard realized, anatomy slab, it's a little bit too late. Right. But this is, I think, a quite a remarkable picture of what a morgue looked like at that time. This is also done at Bellevue. This is the first recorded blood transfusion. Bellevue never looked this good. This was a stage photograph, but what you, and this was also before blood types were known, so it was a rather dangerous procedure. But what you see is one man is giving blood to another. There is a doctor in the middle holding a pump, which is sort of limiting the flow of blood. And you say to yourself, well, how much blood do they know went through? And the answer was, if you could believe it, they would weigh the patient before and after. And that was the determining factor. But I think this is a really remarkable picture. That is the first blood transfusion. It's a little interesting. This is Louis Serre, the father of orthopedic surgery. Louis Serre was a genius, and he also was he was the first physician to really use circumcision as a medical rather than a religious procedure. In this case, Louis Serre, is dealing with a woman who has Pott's disease, and he believed that you could straighten the spine with what he called his tripod derrick. What is most interesting to me about this particular photograph, it's in a medical book. If it hadn't been in a medical book in the Victorian era, he may well have been arrested. This was such a salacious picture, and it sold beyond medical books. That's the interesting thing. This is probably O.G. Mason's most famous photograph. It's a woman with elephantiasis, and you can see above she's normal, below she has the disease. O.G. Mason photographed thousands and thousands of patients at Bellevue, and he also tried to do it in a way where the photograph was a work of art. So in this one, he has her in a praying position, and there is a kind of modesty to it in that she has a shawl that is completely covering her face. And the photograph became so iconic that they called it Bellevue Venus. This is what the famous Bellevue Venus photograph. They tried some things at Bellevue that were a little bit, shall we say, off the curve, like early plastic surgery. This is rhinoplasty. They did a lot of this after the Civil War because so many of the veterans came back with parts of their faces shot away. This was a man who basically had no nose. What they did was to take his middle finger and attach it to that area with wires, and they put two puncture holes in it, did away with the nose, and he had to stay in this position for 3 months until the finger attached to the face and became his nose. This is the late 1870s, early 1880s. Here is the final result, which the patient seemed rather pleased with. As the lead surgeon said, at least he had a nose. It gives you sort of a sense of the progression of surgery and the experimentation that went on, particularly among uncomplaining patients at Bellevue. Anyone recognize this woman? Did someone say Nellie Bly? Correct. Oh, that is.
Oh, get out.
Nellie Bly was the most famous female reporter of that era. She was a daredevil. When Jules Verne did Around the World in 80 days, Nellie Bly traveled around the world in 76 days. She worked for Joseph Pulitzer, who ran the New York World, and this was an era when basically there were amazing subscription wars. It was yellow journalism. Anything went. And Nellie Bly decided that she would, with Joseph Pulitzer's agreement, find her way into Bellevue and then into the state mental facility. And it was her going to Bellevue and then writing it up in these two sensational articles called 10 Days in a Madhouse that gave Bellevue a kind of reputation from which it could never escape. So many things were going on at Bellevue. So much progress was being made. But because of the indomitable Nellie Bly, Bellevue would always be associated with madness. That's a picture, actually a rendering, of Bellevue, the new Bellevue Hospital in 1900. And the architects were McKim, Mead, and White, the greatest, basically the greatest architects in the United States. And some New York City mayors really had a good feeling for Bellevue because it was the immigrant hospital and a lot of votes were attached to it. So what McKim, Mead, and White did was to put together this palatial image in 1900. Now, they did away with a lot of the more expensive columns and marble and light, but the old Bellevue today, if you walk there on 28th Street, looks very much like this. I'm going to go very briefly through a couple of Bellevue folks. This is Loretta Bender. Loretta Bender was head of child psychiatry at Bellevue from the 1930s to the 1950s. She's forgotten today, except on the internet. Loretta Bender was a terrific psychiatrist, and she was one of the first people to define autism. And she was the only person early on who did not see autism as due to the coldness of the mother. She saw it as something that was a much deeper psychiatric problem. What Bender did, however, as a way of trying to shake children out of autism and make them more amenable to other therapies, was to give them electric shock treatment. And Bender gave hundreds of children as young as 4 years old electric shock treatment during the 30s, 40s, and 50s. It is among Bellevue's most controversial legacies. Bellevue then did away with all electric shock, including adult electric shock, shortly afterwards, as did many hospitals after the medical rights movement came and One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest became what electric shock looked like. As electric shock is back now at Bellevue, and it's very successful, but is only being used on people over the age of 20 years old. I have an entire chapter on Loretta Bender. If you look her up on the internet, you will see that she is seen as the twin of Joseph Mengele, you know, like a quote-unquote Nazi doctor. The story is much, much more complicated. This is interesting. Bellevue was one of the first hospitals to see AIDS patients. More AIDS patients were treated and more AIDS patients were died at Bellevue than in any other hospital in the United States. And what you're seeing are the earliest New York surveillance figures, where 153 cases have been brought in with conditions that just weren't seen, and they can't make heads or tails out of it. Now, if there are any physicians in the room, what is KS? Kaposi's sarcoma, which became sort of almost the defining mark of the AIDS patient. And that is a very rare cancer, generally known to middle-aged Mediterranean men. And yet it was striking. What about PCP? Pneumocystis pneumonia. And that was the other telltale thing early on. And what you see is that virtually all of them had one or the other or both of these conditions. And at this point, virtually all of them were men. All right? What made Bellevue different than other hospitals, say San Francisco General, is that San Francisco General, throughout the AIDS epidemic, was largely for gay men. Bellevue, by the mid-1980s, was seeing more drug-related AIDS cases than gay-related AIDS cases, and they were much more difficult to treat. This is Linda Laubenstein, one of the heroes of my book. She was 4'10" tall and had polio. She was a human rights advocate, and at one point in the early 1980s, was treating 25% of all of the AIDS patients in New York City. The reason being that most doctors at this time, when no one knew, all they knew was that AIDS was fatal and that there was no cure, and they couldn't even put together what it was. Many doctors actually shied away from treating it. And there's a long story about the AMA, which I don't have time to go into. Linda Laubenstein treated them all. And in Larry Kramer's famous play, which later became a movie, Linda Laubenstein is the heroine. She's 4'10" and had polio and had to get around in a wheelchair, but she was played in the HBO movie by Julia Roberts. Probably not the best, but Julia Roberts was quite good. For a while, Barbara Streisand had bought the rights, and she wanted to play Linda Laubenstein, and Laubenstein really did not want that. And the one thing Laubenstein said, it was very funny, she said, "Tell Streisand, if she gets the part, she better clip her nails if she's going to do a rectal." All right. This is the low point of. Oh, I got to sleep. Stay here. This is the low point of Bellevue Hospital. This was Catherine Hinnant, a young pregnant pathologist at Bellevue, who was murdered in 1989 by a homeless man in the hospital. What made the case so controversial was that the homeless man had gone in for psychiatric treatment, had been released against his wishes, had come back to the hospital, and was squatting there, unknown to the staff, in a machinery room for 3 weeks. And what became clear was that this homeless man was not a single case. There were squatters all over the hospital. This was the height of the homeless problem in New York City. Bellevue was right next door to the largest homeless shelter in the city, and the homeless population began to use Bellevue as kind of an appendage of the homeless shelter, using the restrooms, the lobby, stealing food off patients' trays, and the like. And my feeling is, and I agree it's controversial, not everyone at Bellevue believes it, But my feeling is that it was the Bellevue credo. We turn no one away. Everyone here, even if we do not admit, can stay here and get a meal and something to drink and a coat and shoes. And it was because of that message that Bellevue kind of blurred the line between patient and visitor. It began to look like a bus station, like the Port Authority. And the question is whether Catherine Hinnant died for our liberal sins. Security was not very good. It increased dramatically after her murder, but basically it took the murder of a young pregnant pathologist to have Bellevue realize how serious the squatting homeless problem had become. In 2012, Hurricane Sandy hit New York City. It was devastating. There are parts of the Jersey Shore, Long Island, Lower Manhattan that still have not recovered from Hurricane Sandy. The storm surge was so great that all of Lower Manhattan below 39th Street was blacked out for more than a week. Food stores were closed. Hospitals had to close. There were no traffic lights. There was no transportation. It was like you were on an island. And above 39th Street, life went on as normal. It was absolutely extraordinary. Bellevue was flooded. The East River just surged in, and Bellevue had all of its important equipment in the basement. And by that, I mean its wall oxygen, where it got sent up, was in the basement, and also its major generators were in the basement, which basically gave power to the hospital. Bellevue had emergency generators on the 13th floor, but you had to get fuel up there. And what you see on the left are physicians, nurses, maintenance men, everyone who worked in that hospital, forming these endless lines to take up 5-gallon and 10-gallon and 15-gallon of jugs of petroleum to keep the hospital going with those emergency generators. Now, those emergency generators could only produce a minimum of power. And Bellevue actually, like coming out of Hurricane Katrina, made a list in its ICU, 1 to 58, of which patients should receive help, really life-saving help, as resources dwindled. The toilets backed up. There was no food. The air conditioning failed. And finally, after 2 days, it was decided the hospital had to be evacuated. Most hospitals had evacuated long before, but Bellevue never closes. And the picture on the right are the National Guard and doctors and nurses taking patients down the stairwell one by one. And what I will close with is think of a hospital with close to 1,000 patients. You have to move some of them down 22 flights of stairs attached to all kinds of life-saving equipment. You have to move a prison unit, some of them psychiatric prisoners. You have to daisy chain them together and surround them with police and move them down the stairs. You have to move drug-resistant TB patients down the stairs. Hundreds of psychiatric patients down the stairs. And they did this over an 18-hour period. Every patient got out. No patient was injured. No patient died. And that really is the Bellevue credo. And it goes on today. When they had their single Ebola patient in New York, where did that Ebola patient go? The patient went to Bellevue. That's the place you take it. It is our ultimate safety valve hospital. It is our hospital that turns no one away. And it's our hospital that, in the new world of medicine, as a public institution, is becoming increasingly vulnerable. My sense is that this is the best there is. taking care of people that other hospitals find it very, very difficult to take care of. So may she continue. Thank you very much. Happy to take any questions. There's a microphone set up there. Or if you'd like to do it just from the audience, that's fine. Sure.
I wonder if you could just mention a few things about the sources you used.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the material.
Yeah, sure.
How you got access to them.
Sure.
And then separate question is just to touch on maybe some of the bacteriology.
Okay.
Other than
Welch and Bruton. Yeah, sure. Actually, I will, if you don't mind, Dr. Markle, I would like you to take that question on bacteriology.
Okay.
Good. He is the expert's expert on this. In terms of sources, I ran into an immediate brick wall, and that was that Hurricane Sandy wiped out the archives. They're gone. They were on a lower floor, and they're largely gone. I did get to use some of them, and fortunately there was a woman who had written about Bellevue who had lots of copies in her house in Poughkeepsie, New York, thank God. And I used those as well. But there's a lot of backup, and by that I mean you can use the New York Academy of Medicine, which is incredible, the New York Historical Society, the Johns Hopkins University Archives, the National Archives, and Bellevue. And the various census. And Bellevue puts out, and has from the 1800s, puts out a report every single year on the number of patients, their nationality, where they come from, why they were admitted, when they were let out, what the disease was, who the doctor was, that are extremely important. The other thing that I did, which I was very fortunate, is that I interviewed dozens and dozens and dozens of people. Who were part of the, who either worked at Bellevue as doctors, nurses, did their training there, were medical students there and the like. And they're very, very willing to talk because Bellevue, most of them see Bellevue as a very special place with a special mission. As for bacteriology?
Well, those annual reports, by the way, are excellent.
Yeah.
They really are. Bacteriology in Bellevue is fascinating, as you know, Paul, because the first municipal bacteriology lab was the City of New York's at Bellevue, run by Herman Biggs, one of the great public health reformers. But that was 1892, and it was after the cholera pandemic, where only a handful of cases came to the United States. I'd like to offer a more nuanced account of bacteriology, particularly with Frank Hamilton, versus the more proactive Young Turks, like people like Halstead. So
right.
There were, as you know so well, Paul, there were contagionists, people who believed in the germ theory very early on, not just with Pasteur, but with Koch in 1876, and then with Lister between the 1860s and on. But there were many others, anti-contagionists, who simply did not believe that a tiny little microbe could fall a huge man or a woman. And many of the most prominent anti-contagionists were on the faculty.
That is correct.
So not only is Frank Hamilton a surge, by the way, ballistics, because bullets were balls, and the treatment, you had to get that ball out. That was the thought. That's why everybody's probing
right.
People with gunshot wounds. But not only Frank Hamilton, but my favorite is Alfred Loomis, a great internist who wrote book after book on physical diagnosis, who got on the stage in 1881 or 82 after the TB tubercle was announced by Koch. He said to his students, you know, people say there are germs in the air, but I don't see them.
And everybody
and
laughed.
The medical students laughed.
Right,
and
right.
That was funny. And Herman Biggs, a young medical student, rushed to William Henry Welch to tell him that story. And Welch said that that's a shame. He was such a nice man.
Yeah.
And Welch understood that Loomis was a dinosaur. That's easy to say now and see that now. But at the time, this was a heated, heated debate.
Yes.
And there were plenty of people who just simply didn't believe in it. And so as opposed to a light switch, and there are very few light switch moments I can think of in the history of medicine, maybe ether, but as opposed to a light switch, yes, let's all go to this route of operating, treating, what have you. It was a very a snowball going down a hill, gaining speed and size with each revolution. But from 1870 to at least 1892,
that's
it was still quite out.
It is.
And that's why when you talk about Grover Cleveland, that's 1896.
1896, that's right, yeah.
Different world.
It's a different world,
but it's the step-by-step progress. So a lot of good stuff was done.
Right.
And a lot of roadblocking was
right.
done. And I don't think that's much different from...
That is right. One of the interesting things is that that Loomis story is quite amazing, where Welsh said he's such a nice man. Welsh then, several years later, got a job offer from Johns Hopkins, which was just organizing. And there was a major movement to keep him and keep bacteriology at Bellevue. Andrew Carnegie gave $50,000 to build an institute right on the Bellevue grounds that Welsh would head. And I came across a letter at Hopkins where Loomis, realizing, despite his feelings about Welsh, that Welsh is leaving, because Welsh is so popular now with students, Loomis actually sends him a letter saying, please stay, and you can actually take over, when I retire, you can take over my job. So what Dr. Markle said is spot on, but it's sort of a, you know, it's a step-by-step process. And the Young Turks included Halstead and Welsh. And that is, to me, a very, very interesting. Any other questions? Anybody? Yes. Yes, sir. Oh.
Hey, Dr. Oshinsky.
Hi.
I just wondered if you could speak to the difference between New York Presbyterian, because I know that also has a sterling reputation as a hospital in Manhattan, and how they differ in terms of patient population and how Bellevue has remained, I guess, the place for the Pope, the President.
Sure. New York Hospital, like the Catherine Hinnant incident, has had its share of disasters, the Libby Zion case, which obviously changed house staff medicine, to put it mildly, a number of other cases. The difference really is that, and when you go to New York Presbyterian Hospital, their emergency room has to take anybody. I mean, it's federal law, basically. They will take in patients like Bellevue will take in. What New York Presbyterian will often do is, as quickly as possible, is to try to move that patient to a public hospital. And Bellevue is often the receptacle. And that does happen. You can call it ambulance dumping. You call it what you want. But that does happen with some frequency. The difference is that Bellevue is the place. You just know it when someone is picked up off the street and clearly is homeless. They will often have a choice, but among hospitals, Bellevue is the only choice. They will be given a couple of shelters, or they can be taken to Bellevue, where they will be deloused, and they'll be given a physical examination, and if necessary, they'll receive emergency care. If necessary, they will be admitted. So Bellevue is sort of a conveyor belt. It's also the place that is known for taking the uninsured, the undocumented. It's basically they get their care for free. They get it through emergency Medicare. There's what is known as disproportionate hospital legislation, where hospitals are taking a larger number of these people, get some funding from the state and from the federal government. The city also pays, fairly large amounts of money to keep Bellevue alive. And as I mentioned yesterday to students, unlike a New York hospital, which may have a New York Presbyterian, which may have a few, Bellevue has a large number of what are called alternative care patients. And these are patients who come to Bellevue Hospital, are treated, are admitted, and then never leave. They may be there for 2 months, maybe 4 months, 4 years, they may die there. They take up a large number of beds, sometimes often 10% of the beds. And the reason is, although these people were brought in for an emergency and no longer need emergency care, there is no place to put them. Their families don't want them. Some of the shelters reject them, so they simply stay where they are. That gives Bellevue a very, very different flavor. And it really talks to the fact that Bellevue, if you would look at New York Hospital, what is the average length of stay at New York Hospital or New York Presbyterian? And you would look at Bellevue Hospital, it's probably twice as long at Bellevue, even longer than it is at a hospital like New York Presbyterian. They both do wonderful medicine, but to a large extent, they serve different constituencies. Okay. Yes?
Can you comment on the relationship between Bellevue and Rikers Island?
Sure. You all know Rikers Island. Who doesn't know Rikers Island? It's the largest urban prison in the country. If you have a prisoner at Rikers Island who's hurt in a fight, if you have a prisoner who has a terrible infection, who has some sort of issue that cannot be dealt with in the small hospital facility at Rikers Island, they come to Bellevue. They come to Bellevue and they are shackled. They're brought up to a prison ward. Dr. Markle has seen it. It's guarded by corrections officers who are armed, and they receive first-rate medical care. When they are deemed ready to leave, they are brought back by bus, corrections bus, to Rikers Island. But those wards are always full. And it varies among doctors. The medical wards at Rikers Island are fine. The psychiatric wards are tricky at Rikers Island for various reasons. They're very, very tricky. A lot of these patients are HIV positive and have all kinds of multiple infections that go along with it. The New York City pays NYU Medical School close to $200 million a year, and NYU provides all of the medical care, including in the prison ward. That's on the 19th floor. And generally, most people don't get a tour of it, but come visit me. We'll go up and take a look. Okay. Yes?
I was wondering if you knew where the financial resources came from originally to start Bellevue and where the name Bellevue came from.
Sure. Good questions. The city of New York, Bellevue basically was named for an estate called BEL-VUE. That estate was on the East River. That is where the original Bellevue was. And if you look at New York City now, Bellevue's on the east side, on East 1st Avenue and East 26th Street. It's almost the Lower East Side. In the 1730s, Bellevue was 2.5 miles outside of where everyone lived in New York. Everyone lived down by the Staten Island Ferry, right down by the Battery. And Bellevue was far enough away to be out of sight, out of mind. So that's where you sent your infectious people. That's where you sent your so-called maniacs and idiots. And so that is
when it began, with city money, and that is why it is where it is. They wanted it far away. They want as far away as they could get. Okay. Any other questions? Well, thank you very much. Oh, you know, I'll answer your question personally. Come visit me in the back.
We have lots of books that are so fresh off the presses, they're warm. I told Dr. Oshinsky we'll sign each and every one. And I want to thank him personally for coming to Ann Arbor.
Thank you. This leads off my book tour. And what a great, I'll just say finally, what a great place. My wife Jane is a Michigan graduate. We come back every chance we get, and we love Ann Arbor.